This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. My guest is Dacher Keltner. He is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and a faculty director of the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center. He studies the science of compassion, awe, love, and beauty, and how emotions shape our moral intuition. His research interests also span the issues of power, status, inequality, and social class. He is the author of the best-selling book, Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and co-editor of The Compassionate Instinct. Today we are talking about his new book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dacher Keltner, thanks for coming into KBOO while you're in Portland.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen.
Now, you've spent over 20 years studying how people get, use, and abuse power. Can I ask you how you first became interested in the issue of power?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Kathleen. I was actually 20 years ago studying things like depression and anxiety how kids have trouble adjusting to school. And, you know, I do a lot of work looking at nonverbal behavior and how people behave. And when I looked at things like depression, it really looked like a form of submissiveness, right, or a form of a sense of loss of status. And when I consulted my literature, psychology, we had very little to say about how hierarchies and power and submissiveness influence the mind and our emotions and our nervous systems. And so 20 years ago, I began the research.
And what is the definition of power, and how did you come to that definition?
Well, what a terrific question. I mean, that was in some ways one of the hardest things to do, and it occupies the first chapter of the power paradox. So, you know, typically in the social sciences, and I think in a lot of people's intuitions, we think of power as money or fame or might, right? But that, for me, was not satisfying. It didn't really help us think about the power dynamics between a two-year-old and a parent, or the power dynamics in seventh grade, which are very powerful. Or, you know, and I know your listeners will be thinking of this, all of the social change that happens by people who don't have money or might or political access. So I define power, and the field has moved in this direction, as a person's capacity to influence the state of another person. You know, and that influence can be with an idea, it can be with an act of compassion, it can be with money, it can be with force, but it really is about influencing the state of other people.
You make the point that it's shifting a lot of the time.
Yeah, and this is another thing. You know, we think, well, you know, I'm a professor at Berkeley and I'm powerful, right? And then I go home and I feel powerless around my kids, and, you know, and then I move into another context and I feel. So one of the things that we really have to grapple with, and psychologists, this is what we do, which is to think about power not as a position, but as a mental state, right? As something that shifts from one context to another. And then the question is what is that feeling of power due to our behavior?
You've done a lot of research on this.
Yeah.
And I want you to use some of the examples of your research.
Sure.
If you would, when in answering some of these questions. But you do say that enduring power comes from empathy and giving. Can you expand on how people get power?
Yeah, this was one of the big surprises that I write about in The Power Paradox, Kathleen. So, you know, we have these stereotypes that power is really a kind of gained by Machiavellian strategies, you know, being manipulative and hiding stuff and deceptive and even strategically aggressive, right? But in actuality, when you study how people gain the respect of other people and power and influence, it's through empathy and more pro-social tendencies. So here, there are studies showing, for example, that from kids to people at work, that if you're good at reading other people's emotions, right, and we would study people, for example, kids in a summer camp or students who are just coming to college, and then you measure people's ability to read other people's emotions, empathy, and then you follow those people over time and see where they end up in that group, and they tend to rise in social power and their ability to influence others if you are a careful student of other people. You know, one of my favorite quotes about this is what Thurlow Weed said about Abraham Lincoln, probably our greatest president. He said, you know, the political genius of Lincoln was that he hears and sees everybody who come to him, right? He really respects other people and empathizes. So we learned in a lot of different studies that it's really your ability to connect to people and read them and think about them that predicts power. And then there's this other, you know, to your second point, there's this really surprising finding in the literature that is now being replicated in a lot of places, that it's really people who share ideas, encouragement, resources, opportunities that rise in power. This is, for example, robustly shown in hunter-gatherer societies, which I write about in The Power Paradox, where it's really the woman or the man who shares a lot of food who has the respect of the community, right, and has status. So empathy and kindness prove to be good ways to get power.
And there's some other elements, too, storytelling.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little
Yeah,
bit?
You know, that was another surprise, you know. And again, it was fun to consult historical analyses of great leaders. And, you know, what you find is, like, Lincoln was a great storyteller, and his dad loved to tell stories and taught young Abe how to tell stories. And even though Lincoln was poor and awkward and a little unusual looking, he, in a way, won the presidency through storytelling. You know, we are a storytelling species. It's one of the basic ways in which we unite our communities, right? Older villages in many different parts of the world had individuals whose role it was to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Maybe even journalism serves that function today.
Right.
And so, guided by that thinking that stories are so powerful and uniting and entertaining and teaching, right? Teaching about ideas that unite us. We've done a bunch of funny studies. You know, we did one study where we looked at kids at a summer camp, and we gave them a chance to kind of do a funny story to kind of joke around with friends. And it was really the good storytellers who gained the respect of their peers later in that camp. We did studies of social groups on college campuses. And again, we let them kind of tease each other and joke around like people in a group do. And it was, again, the really funny, lighthearted, empowering storytellers who rose in power. And so I've made the case in The Power Paradox that this is just one of these powerful ways that we can gain the respect of other people.
And that reminds me, some of the, in the book, you also mentioned the aspect of touch.
Yeah.
And how yeah. people related to each other, and how that led to feelings about people and their relationship to power.
You know, as your listeners will get a sense of, you know, I take an evolutionary perspective toward, you know, how we get power, and also other things I study like compassion. And, you know, when you think about those small groups in which we evolved, you know, for a couple hundred thousand years, power wasn't necessarily about your bank account or your control over, you know, Instagram. Rather, it was face-to-face stuff, right? It was mm-hmm. just basic social behaviors. And touch is one of the most powerful ways in which we communicate with other people. It involves cells in your skin, and your skin has billions of cells. It's 8 pounds of, you know, fascinating sort of systems that process information about who's around you. And touch is also really the first kind of way in which we connect to young babies, right, and other people. And there was this science that was emerging that shows, you know, if I pat you on the back, you feel rewarded, you feel comfortable, your stress system calms down. This is why touch is increasingly used in certain medical contexts. And you're more likely to trust me and to sort of collaborate with me. And so we've done a variety of studies. One of the most funny is, you know, we looked at teams in the National Basketball Association, including the Trailblazers. And we coded at the start of the season, how much are the teammates touching each other? Because basketball players have this great language of touch. And we found that the more that they touched each other at the start of the season with, you know, fist bumps and arm, or, you know, embraces and, you know, head wraps and so forth, the better they played, the more powerful they were at the end of the season. They're just more successful. So touch is this great language alongside sharing and expressing gratitude and the like that really gives you respect and power in groups.
So there comes a point in this book, The Power Paradox, where you explain what the paradox is.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Who's affected by it and how the seductions of power influence us?
Yeah. You know, and I know your listeners are like, God, you know, this guy, you know, he's from Berkeley, you know, and he's telling me that being kind and sharing and, you know, encouraging is good for power. And that is true. And I'm sure they're thinking, they're scratching their heads like, yeah, but when I think about, you know, Donald Trump or, you know, politicians or, you know, Johnny Manziel, you know, just time and time again, you see people in the news. I mean, you know, three people in Alabama right now, federal judge and or a Supreme Court judge and a governor in trouble for ethical violations. You know, what gives? Why? What are those guys doing or those people? And that's the paradox, which is that we do rise in power through really being empathetic and pro-social stuff, pro-social tendencies. But once we feel powerful or we come from a life of privilege, like a lot of our politicians today, right, where we're born into, you know, these very insulated elite lives, then you're likely to abuse your power. And, you know, Kathleen, we found this. There are hundreds of studies of this. One of my favorites that I profile in The Power Paradox was one of our first, where, you know, we brought people to the lab. There were three people in a group. We randomly assigned one person to a position of power, and we said, you're in charge, right? And then they proceeded for the next hour to kind of write policies for the university and read stuff and, you know, do a group decision-making task. Halfway into the study, we bring in a plate of 5 chocolate chip cookies. Everybody takes a cookie because these are young people and they're hungry. All groups leave one cookie on the plate. So our key question was, who takes that 4th cookie? And it was the powerful person almost all of the time. Hmm. And then what we did is we coded how they ate, and the person who was randomly assigned to a position of power ate with their mouths open, their lips smacking, and crumbs falling onto their sweaters, right? They're impulsive. And that then led to all of these studies that show that once we feel powerful or privileged or above others, we not only eat impulsively, we swear at people, we interrupt them, we're not as good at listening to them, we engage in inappropriate sexual behavior, we make, you know, sexual harassment, you know, we are more likely to cheat and lie in experiments. And even studies find, this wasn't our work, that people who are wealthy and privileged are more likely to shoplift. They're the ones who are taking stuff they can easily afford. So, you know, this is an old idea. Power corrupts, and it really shows up in lab experiments.
How do you make sense of these two ideas, this idea that, yeah, you know, you have this very compassionate kind of way that people get, yeah, power, and then they get corrupted? Is it everybody that gets corrupted, or what? How do you reconcile those two things in the power paradox?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that the reconciliation is to recognize that human nature is complicated, right? And these are just dynamic forces of, we are, in many ways, we're at our best when we're trying to integrate into communities and rise or gain respect of people. Let me give another example. You know, we've studied altruism in our lab, and who shares resources, one of the best things humans do, turns out it's people who are powerless and poor. The poor share more in our studies time and time again, because it's a way to build community, adapt, and gain respect. So this is just one of these complex dynamics in humans, which is we rise to power through what's good, and then very often power kind of unleashes what is problematic in human behavior. You know, it is an inevitable. You can think of leaders who stay close to the practices that got them power and keep advancing the welfare of societies. You can think about people in your own community who use their power for forces of good. And that's one of my hopes of this book, is to say power is this energizing force. It can unleash a lot of action and make it for the good. And it really is quite simple, which is power tends to kind of orient your attention to your own self-interest. And the key to good power is to keep serving other people's interests.
I'm speaking with Decker Keltner. He is professor of psychology at the University of California, and he is the author of several books, including most recently, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. I wanted to talk about the issue of powerlessness, which you brought up a little bit more. You write about the price of powerlessness and how powerless people are affected in all kinds of ways. Can you talk more about the effects of powerlessness on people?
Well, you know, Kathleen, in many ways, the costs or price of powerlessness, which is the second to last chapter of The Power Paradox, was maybe the most important reason why I wrote this book. I had a really interesting experience growing up, if you don't mind my describing it. My mom got her PhD at UCLA, and we lived in a middle to upper middle class neighborhood, you know, when houses were affordable back then, and in Laurel Canyon. And then my parents in 1970 moved to a very poor rural town because we wanted to live out in the country in what was one of the poorest counties in California. And I had this really interesting experience as a 9-year-old kid where, you know, I went from this kind of high functioning school, you know, with and then I went to this town and the kids were great. The parents meant so well. People were so kind in my poor little rural town. But I kid you not, people were dying young. You know, there were people on my little lane of KO Drive who were dying in their 40s and 50s of weird diseases, who were really suffering poor health. And I didn't really think about it when I was 9. But then when I started to study power 20 years ago, these findings started to come in, and they were, I think, some of the most important findings in psychology. And the very simple finding is that it was of Nancy Adler that if you imagine a 10-rung ladder of United States, and then you put yourself on that ladder, so like I'm a 7, in terms of your status and standing in the country, what Nancy Adler was finding, and this is replicated dozens of times, is that for every drop down the ladder, you are suffering more from, you know, diabetes and heart problems and asthma as a kid. And you're, if you get a disease, you're more like, you die earlier, even if they have the same medical care, right? And that tells us that, and this is 20 years ago, wow, if I feel below someone, like my neighbors on KO Drive in this little town, my health really suffers, right? It's powerlessness. And what we then did, and a lot of scientists have joined in on that, is to try to figure out, well, why is that? Why? And what we've learned, and I think this is in large part because we're more of an egalitarian species than today's economic conditions would suggest, that when I feel below people, my stress system goes on overdrive. When I feel the target of sexist ideas, and that is an attack on me, my stress system goes on overdrive. If I'm African-American and the subject of somebody stereotyping, my stress system goes on overdrive, and then the stress system starts destroying your body.
Yeah, you say that something about reduced power gnaws at our nervous system.
It does, and you know, it's startling how powerful this is, Kathleen. So, you know, what the focus right now in the science is on the stress hormone cortisol. And we know from dozens of studies that if you have elevated cortisol, it elevates your stress and your cardiovascular response, and it starts to hyperactivate your digestive system and the like, and your immune system, and it wears them down. It wears down your veins and arteries and the like. So much so, there are studies now looking at little strands of tissue called telomeres on your DNA. And if I'm powerlessness or in a circumstance of stress and disempowerment, those strands start aging prematurely, and your cells start aging fast if you're powerless. And then the other focus in the literature is on something I study in my Berkeley lab, which is the inflammation response or a cytokine response, which is where your body has these cells that attack toxins in your body, like a virus, and your body inflames like you have a flu, right? And you're sluggish and sleepy and you have runny nose, which is part of the inflammation response, which is great if you have toxins in your body. But now we're learning, if I feel disrespected or powerless, or if I'm born into poverty, it hyperactivates that system. And that is bad news for your body's health.
Mm. So that generally leads to the conclusion that inequality is bad for society.
It is. And, you know, your listeners may have heard of a book, The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett. And, you know, there are just a lot of social biological scientists like me who are starting to just present data for the public to consider that this, that being below others, which is made worse by inequality, is really bad for your physical body and your health. And then I think it, you know, I'm hoping that policymakers will grapple with those data, mm-hmm. right, that are now worldwide.
When I first was reading your book and thinking about these issues, and I'm sure you get this all the time, in fact,
yeah.
about thinking about Donald Trump, for
yeah.
instance, and you you do have a line in the book where you say it's not a book about politics. So how do you talk about that these
yeah.
days?
Yeah. You know, when I wrote this, I don't know, it was 9 months ago or, you know, and Donald Trump was a blip on the radar screen. And, you know, and then he took the Republican Party by storm. You know, what we know, you know, this is not going to surprise your listeners, but Trump is a classic abuser of power. You know, and he's exploited people economically. He clearly is sexist in his language and his treatment of women. He is clearly xenophobic and really travels in the currency of fear and hatred, like Machiavelli did, who I critique in the book. And what we know, and I think we're already seeing really subtle signs of this, which is that that strategy, that very Machiavellian rise in power by instilling fear and taking other people down, like immigrants and Mexican Americans, that strategy impassions some people. And given a quirky Republican primary with so many candidates, he prevailed. But in the long haul, that strategy fails and disempowers. And I think it's a pretty safe prediction, and we're already seeing signs of this, that should he prevail, it will weaken the United States, right, internally. It already has. You know, when you look at the trust that is the fabric of our society, he's tearing it to shreds. And it'll weaken the U.S., as people like Joseph Nye at Harvard are arguing. It'll weaken the U.S.'s standing on the world stage. Other countries are already looking at us like, well, that's the end of that democratic power. So I think it's a disaster. Not surprising to your audience.
And so we get to the area of the path to power. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I teach leaders of all kinds at UC Berkeley, you know, in my career. You know, and I'll teach people, school administrators and healthcare administrators and people at Facebook and Google and science who are running big labs and government and so forth. And they know the power paradox very intimately. And I would also say, you know, I teach parent groups all the time. And they start nodding their head like, yeah, this is my struggle with my four-year-old. You know, it's like we start getting into these conflicts and then, you know, I yell at them or whatever it is. And so what I try to direct the reader to in that last epilogue is a path to enduring power. It's interesting. You know, in a lot of realms, people have thought that power, this is an old debate too, like how I lead should be independent of ethics, right? And like power is all about getting things done and you shouldn't be guided by ethics. And that's actually an old Machiavellian idea. And I think it's an idea, for example, that governs Wall Street, right? Which is, this is just about capital. We don't worry about ethical considerations to the extent that other places do, like schools. And I think that's a big mistake. What I write about in that last chapter is some of the ideas by which in every moment of your life, when you're engaged in influencing others and being influenced, there are principles you can stick close to, like being humble and always recognizing your fallibility. And then it turns out there are new studies coming out that, you know, great leaders tend to be really humble. I also write about, you know, returning to a sense of sharing. You know, I think, you know, this will not surprise your audience. People who have a lot of economic power or one percenters need to think about sharing more, mm-hmm. right, as a form of happiness and empowerment. So I think there are some simple ideas to redirect the course of our power.
Is that line of thought ever critiqued by somebody who doesn't have power, who wants to get power, you know, who is like an activist.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Activists working for an idea or for equal status or whatever, and they're hearing those things and they're thinking, well, that's not what I think. That would just push me down, but it wouldn't get me the result that I'm really looking for.
Yeah, no, that's a very serious question, you know, and it is a question, you know, your more activist listeners should probably have is, does all this kindness, you know, and collaboration really work when we're fighting for justice?
Mm-hmm.
And I was worried about that too, you know, being somebody who volunteers and so forth on issues related to justice. But what I can tell you, you know, it's really interesting, Kathleen, as I was writing this book, The Power Paradox, there are these really interesting historians who looked at protest movements, right? And they were interested in, like, how, if you don't have money and you don't have the military behind you, and you don't have typical political support, how do you change societies? And this has happened over the course of history. And these are forms of political protest they've studied, you know, as like in India or Indonesia or the like, which are where you're really up against a violent military. Who wins? How, what's the strategy? And they looked at two kinds of protest movements across hundreds of historical examples. One is more violent, ISIS-like, you know, Machiavellian, like kill people, take hostages and the like, blow buildings up. And then the other is more collaborative, get the people out in numbers, right? Build up community, do the more peaceful approaches. And I already see you're nodding your head, but the peaceful approaches win, right? Uh-huh. They're more likely to get stuff done, more likely to change politics in those repressive countries. So I know it can seem counterintuitive that collaboration and kindness is a path to power when you're fighting against injustice, but I take heart in those findings. I'm sure some of your listeners have read Howard Zinn's A Power That the Government Can't Deny or something like that. That's this inspiring historical tour of all of these movements for social change. You know, obviously the civil rights movement, which began with Ella Baker and others, that really tells us that there is something to collaboration and building networks that's powerful.
At the end of your book, you say that carrying out the science that led to the book changed your view of wishing for a society that was power-free.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, when I was young, you know, I was raised and grew up in the late 60s and by activist parents. My mom is a, you know, very deep community activist. You know, I kind of had this early intuition, like power is a dirty thing, a dirty word, and it's pernicious and it's ruinous. And doing the science, I've come to the almost the opposite conclusion, which is that I want my daughters to feel powerful. You know, I really do. And I know they do because they're raised in a different era thanks to, you know, women before them and the feminist movement. And I want my students to feel powerful, you know, and I want the prisoners that I go work with in San Quentin prison, you know, in a restorative justice program to feel powerful. And I know that they do. Paradoxically, they're in one of the most oppressive institutions, but I know they feel like their voice gets out beyond the prison walls and it leads to change. So I moved, like you're saying, Kathleen, from this really interesting, like, well, I just wish we no longer had power or hierarchies, to the idea that, you know, let's empower as many people as possible, especially those for whom biases prevent their power, people of different racial backgrounds or gender and the like. So it was a really big switch.
Mm-hmm. And has this topic, has it led to another area of exploration that you're going to follow this with?
You know, so one thing is we are studying inequality and really getting into the nitty gritty. And, you know, it's really incredible. We're finding a country's inequality hurts marriage and romantic partnerships. Mm-hmm. So the more, if you live in a county that's more unequal, your intimate life suffers. We're finding that people feel more shame in unequal cultures. And that's tough news, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that we want to work on. So we are really digging into inequality. And then the second thing is, you know, alongside this work on power and hierarchy, I always investigate emotions that help us live meaningful lives, like compassion, which I wrote about in Born to Be Good. And we're doing a lot of work on awe and the sense of wonder and amazement. And we are finding that awe, like especially what Portland has so much of in Oregon, of nature, restores your nervous system. So now we're taking inner city kids out on these trips with the Sierra Club and showing how beneficial it is. These kids have never seen, half the kids we take out on these trips had never been camping or seen a night sky. Mm-hmm. And literally one day of camping or rafting on these trips, you know, weeks later, their nervous systems look better. They feel more engaged at school. So very interested in thinking about how things like awe and kindness can be used to help people who don't get the breaks in society.
Thank you very much. I want to tell people I have been speaking with Dacher Keltner. He is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also the author of the book we've been talking about, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dacher Keltner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been great.
And this is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. If you want to hear this interview again or miss part of it, you can hear it later today on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.